maybe we need to keep it.
Committee on Agriculture and Veterans will come to order. First bill up today is Senate File 3003, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Before we start, I would like to offer the A4 amendment. It's a delete all amendment. We kept making little changes to this little bill, and pretty soon it became so difficult to engross it that we thought it would just be better to have a delete all so members could actually read the thing in its entirety. And this is its first stop, so I would appreciate support as an author's amendment. One of the things this amendment did is there are several spellings for the word phosphorus. One ends with O-U-S and one ends with U-S. And the common American version is usually U-S, and we had O-U-S in the bill. So everywhere that phosphorus appeared, we changed it to the U-S version. The U.S. version. Plus, there's a few other additional changes that I'll explain in a minute.
Senator Roebling, I'm missing one. I don't have a quorum here. But we can
should
go
I,
ahead. And,
should I speak to the
why
amendment?
Why don't you offer your delete all amendment? We can't act on it till I get one more person, so you can then you can start explaining it if you'd like to.
Okay. Well, this is in essence the bill. It's short, and what it does is intended to educate consumers about the ban that we have placed on using lawn fertilizer with phosphorus. It was an idea that came to my husband and I last year as we were standing in several retail stores looking at fertilizer for our lawn and watching people who really don't know that they aren't supposed to be buying fertilizer with phosphorus trying to decide which fertilizer to purchase. There'll be a stack of bags with the phosphorus fertilizer and a stack of bags that has the non-phosphorus. And even though we passed this law, and there was quite a bit of information about it available when we passed it several years ago, I think a lot of that knowledge has faded. We always have new consumers, new homeowners, new people moving into our state who don't realize that we have a ban on phosphorus fertilizers, with the exception of the items that are listed in the law. And so in order to help educate people, this bill proposes that we ask the wholesalers, the people who provide the phosphorus fertilizers to the retailers, to also provide a sign that would be posted near the phosphorus fertilizer to let people know that there is a ban on using it with exceptions. And so we made a copy or a sample of a sign that could be hung that meets the conditions of what I'm proposing in this bill. And it would say, to protect water quality, Minnesota law prohibits use of lawn fertilizer containing phosphorus except when, and then it lists the four exceptions, for example, when you're establishing a new lawn with cedar sod, you've tested the soil for phosphorus, or you're applying it to a golf course, or you have a sod farm. And that's basically what this does. It does indicate that we need a certain sized typeface. This is the typeface that is mentioned in the bill. It's 3/8 of an inch. It's about 36 point, if you're familiar with point sizes of type. I had someone who was very helpful who also added some other information here that is not required in the bill, but the Department of Ag had indicated that they would be willing to put this on their website, and any business could download this and make it for signs. This actually helps people understand how they know if the fertilizer has phosphorus in it. And it shows that if the middle number is a zero, that is a phosphorus-free lawn fertilizer. And so it gives some additional helpful information. It is not required. So it could look like this, too, without that information. And in fact, we eliminated this portion on the sign. The retailers would have this information but we're not saying it has to be posted on the sign. It is possible that if it wouldn't have to be 11 by 17, we're not saying it has to be. Somebody could actually do this in about an 8 by 10, considering this isn't here anymore, and turn it the other way, perhaps, and still get it on an 8 by 10 sign as well. You know, hopefully our bigger retailers that have bigger displays would use a bigger size. But if you're a small hardware store that's selling some lawn fertilizer, you could just post a smaller one. But something near the display that would let people know. The League of Cities, and we do have someone here from the League that is supportive, they had a provision in their policy recommendations, their 2008 policy recommendations this year, that indicated that they were also seeking some further consumer education on the use of phosphorus products. And so they're here in supportive of the bill. The Department of Ag has been very helpful. In fact, the repealer in the bill simply was in the original law saying that the Department of Ag needed to put out a report on the effect of the law in 2007. And this is the report, and so we're repealing that portion of the law because the report has been made already. But within that report, it does say under their recommendations, it says general public education. Continued public education is needed to reinforce messages and to reach new state residents and individuals caring for a lawn for the first time. Point-of-sale information needs to be provided to fertilizer distributors and retail stores to assist in consumer education. And so I believe that this effort would help meet this recommendation that was in this 2007 report, and we can continue with consumer education on this issue. Does anyone have any questions?
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, and Senator Roebling, I think this is a very good idea. And it's a good way to educate the public as to what they're supposed to do. The one question I have is on line 1.17, where it says 4 feet laterally of the fertilizer display. I'm just wondering if we need that word laterally in there in case, you know, it could be that you may want to put it just above the display, or does it really matter as long as it's within 4 feet of the display?
Mr. Chair, that could be something the committee could decide on. I want it in close proximity. Laterally may not be necessary if they need a little more flexibility. But I do think we maybe want to keep the within 4 feet within it.
Well, and it could be that the most convenient place to hang the sign is immediately above the fertilizer.
Correct. I would be open to an amendment to change that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would move then to delete the word laterally on line 1.17.
We still don't have enough. We need one more. We can talk about it. Senator Rose, you want to vote twice?
No, I just said I'll vote twice. If you need. I'll vote twice if you need me to, Mr. Chair.
I have to. Nobody shows up.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
For the time being, Senator Roebling could just incorporate that in her delete everything since it hasn't been adopted yet.
Okay. I could do that, too.
I know that, but I'm waiting.
And I will incorporate that in my delete everything amendment. We'll eliminate the word laterally.
Mr. Chairman? Just want to make one comment on the change. It is a little bit more of a substantive change than you might realize. I mean, if somebody wanted to put the sign above, this would require that it be within 4 feet of above also, not just see if it was laterally and you were above it, as long you would be able to comply with the lateral thing. But even if you were 10 feet above it or 8 feet above it, this would require that the sign actually be within 4 feet above also.
Mr. Chair, as long as we're talking about that, does this leave open the possibility that somebody could put the sign 4 feet behind the bags of fertilizer? Maybe we need to say within sight of the customer, because I can imagine there might be somebody that puts it 4 feet behind the shelving unit.
Mr. Chair, I suppose that could happen. I'm hoping that since most of the retailers sell both the phosphorus and the non-phosphorus, they won't mind having the sign posted, but I'm not sure how specific we need to be. Maybe laterally is still appropriate.
Well, Senator Roebling, what you're trying to do is talk about phosphorus. I don't think we're going to furnish a ruler for everybody, are we, too?
I'm sorry, the door was open and I couldn't hear that last comment.
Just joking with you. I said we're talking about phosphorus, but I don't think we want to furnish a ruler so everybody knows exactly what 4 feet is. I just put it. You know, some places, maybe, like you said, a small store, maybe they can't do that. Senator Constable, is there any way we can make that easier and still do the same thing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just pointing out that it would have to be, the height would also have to be within 4 feet based on the way I read this. But I think Senator Dill might have a comment on it. So.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, the way I read it is that it could be, if we took out the word laterally, it could be anywhere from 0 mm-hmm. to 4 feet from the display in any direction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. And what's wrong with that?
That's what I was trying to get at, maybe a small store.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I was just pointing out that with the word laterally in there, if a store has a place for a sign that's maybe more than 4 feet above, they would be able to place it there as long as it's directly above and within 4 feet laterally. Now they'd be restricted and they'd have to place it within 4 feet vertically also.
Well, that, to me, that would be... So what's the problem with that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, I was not saying that it was a problem. I was just offering that there is a substantive difference between whether laterally is in there or not. Mr. Chair.
Well, I think... I would think we could just rely on the common sense of the operator and the store owner and the wholesaler, and they'll figure it out for themselves without any further detail. But I still think we should remove laterally.
Well, Senator Engelbretson, let's hear from you.
Yeah. I'll weigh in on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's wrong with 1 foot? Then it's going to get real close to the pile of fertilizer, right? No matter which direction you go. Is it not going to narrow it down, or is it too close?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling, some advice?
It was suggested that we might say that they must post a sign with the fertilizer display and not say how far away it is. I don't know if that would be clear enough if we say that they must post a sign with the fertilizer display.
Senator Roebling, I have Greg Johnson from the League of Cities. Would he help us figure out how this is going to work? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'll see if I can help with this complex issue, but to start with, I just want to make it very clear that this is a policy that the League does fully support. We actually recently amended our phosphorus fertilizer policy to include the specific language requesting that there be a retail signage requirement on this, because we were receiving regular comments from our city officials that they were seeing people not knowing how to read the numbers on the fertilizer bags and just grabbing whichever one was on the closest display to the door and heading out with it. And so we really felt this would add a tremendous amount of needed education. Would agree with the finding in the Department of Ag report that education of the consumer is really the key to get this done. As to the signage, I think retailers typically, once they know there needs to be signage, are going to try and put it close to the display. I doubt there will be a lot of abuse of this. As long as there's a requirement of signage, I don't think my city folks would be tremendously concerned about if it's within 4 feet or just has to be near the display in some other way. Either way, we can make it work as far as how we work with our retailers in our cities.
Senator Dill.
Well, as I was sitting here, I was thinking about all these Republicans out on the countryside that say I'm a bad Republican because I supported a tax increase. So maybe what I should do is retreat to the Republican position of limited government and freedom and as few regulations as possible. And let's quit talking about 1 feet, 4 feet, and just give them the freedom to decide for themselves and do what Senator Roebling is suggesting in deleting the words within 4 feet laterally of, or 4 feet laterally, and just put, say, post a sign with the fertilizer display and let it go at that. Does that sound okay?
Senator Dill and Mr. Chair, I'm okay with that. I do trust the retailers. I don't want to micromanage this too much. We want the information out there. I think that they will understand that it needs to be with the display. When we say with the display, that it means next to it.
So, Mr. Chairman, let's vote for freedom and do that.
Senator Dill, I was trying to keep away from having them to buy a ruler to measure all the time. Okay. We have a quorum now, Senator Roebling. And Senator Robes moved the delete all amendment to...
As amended.
As amended. And Senator... Mr. Chairman,
I think what Senator Roebling is doing is moving the amendment with the change on line 1.16, delete within, 1.17, delete 4 feet laterally of, and insert the with. So it would read, a retailer offering lawn fertilizer containing phosphorus must post a sign with the fertilizer display. So that would be her delete all amendment with that, the A4 amendment with that change that she's offering.
Okay, members, is there any further discussion? Senator Roebling, I'm going to trust you that this bill stays the way it is instead of a dozen other things.
Mr. Chair, I have no intentions of doing anything else with it.
Okay, now we have to move this.
The delete everything amendment.
Delete everything amendment with that change that's in there. Okay, everybody understand that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted. Members, any further discussion? Senator Roebling?
No, I'd just like to thank the Department of Ag for offering to put this on their website so that it's easily accessible to wholesalers, retailers, and thinking of adding this other information on there. I'm hoping stores will pick up on this and further educate people as they post their signs.
And Robes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the bill. Recommend to pass, and where is it going to here? Next.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Metzen's committee has requested it as well. Okay. Did you see a request from that? I know we did. My office received a request.
Recommend a pass to Senator Metzen's committee.
That's fine. I was just trying to make it easy.
Yeah, jobs.
Okay,
appreciate
Senator
Robes that.
Renews your motion that Senate files 3003 as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to state and local governments.
No,
jobs.
Jobs and industry.
Jobs.
Commerce, yeah. Business.
Hey, if they asked for it, I can't do much about it. I'm trying to move it along, but we're going to get into spring, pretty going to be spring pretty quick, you know.
Soon. We hope.
Okay, any further discussion? Not all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, members.
I think that's what
we got. Federal Robes, are you ready for your next one?
Fertilizer on the way.
Will the sign be up yet?
It's a rabble. I don't know. I guess I don't know.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I have two bills here today that I am very pleased to bring you. They are the result of some recommendations that came out of the governor's long-term care task force. I was very pleased to work on that task force over the interim, looking at some of the issues having to do with the Minneapolis Veterans Home and all veterans homes across the state. We came up with a lot of really great recommendations, and I have two of those in bill form before you today. This, again, is, you'll see before you, a collaborative effort where we have the Veterans Department is in agreement. Families think this is a good move. The residents of the veterans' homes, the veterans' groups, the staff members, unions, everybody's on board with this. So I will turn it over to Christine Keel from the department to walk you through the details. Either one.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, we can do Senate File 3281 first. It's the creation of the Advisory Council. Okay. Members of the committee, Christine Keel, Department of Veterans Affairs. Senate File 3281 creates the Veterans Healthcare Advisory Council. This council replaces the board, but they are not a governing board. They are an advisory council. The governor will appoint 9 members from the public. 7 of them have to have extensive expertise in the area of healthcare delivery, long-term care, and veteran services. 1 must be a licensed clinician, and 1 is a member at large. The governor will designate 1 of those 9 members to serve as chair of the advisory council, and the commissioner, as his designee, will serve as an ex officio member of the advisory council. The duties of the council you will find on page 2 of your bill, and they are just simply an advisory council. They are to offer vision in helping develop a strategic plan and looking at trends and current conditions in the long-term care industry.
There's any questions? I think so. Senator Robes, I think when I look at it, that the membership's important, but also on the back, one of the duties, I think that's what we're more concerned about, what is going to take place now with the new change. That's all spelled out from 1 to 6 on the back page.
And, Mr. Chair, I believed I had some recommendations from Mr. Bodern on trying to sync up some language here. Maybe we could hear from him.
Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of things in the bill that may not be completely clear. On page 1, line 18, you'll see the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs, or the Commissioner's designee, is an ex officio member of the council. And unless it's specified, ex officio members are actually voting members, or would have power, the same powers as the other members of the council. Ex officio simply means they hold that position because of the office they hold. If you want to make it a non-voting membership, then I guess I'd say on page 1, line 19, after officio, insert comma non-voting. But I'd leave that to the decision of the committee, of course.
Council, any other?
Then, Mr. Chairman, the other technical issue with this is the expiration date for the council. There is no exemption provided from Section 15059, which provides an automatic expiration date of, I think it's July 1st, 2009, for all advisory groups. So on page 2, after line 23, you could insert, this is a little bit lengthy, but the concept is simple, a new subdivision 5 with a headnote expiration, and the language would read, notwithstanding section 15.059, subdivision 5, the council is permanent and does not expire. The only other thing I point out that's a little, you know, if you go ahead and do that, subdivision 4 does provide on line page 2, line 23, the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs does have the power to disband the council at any time, and it'd be interesting to see how those two work together. One solution, of course, would be to remove that power to dissolve the council and reserve it for the legislature.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you, Mr. Bodern, for helping us point out those areas where we need to identify. I would encourage or maybe add these changes in my amendment. I'll just make an amendment when I put the bill on the table. But, yes, we would like to include non-voting status for the commissioner. He has a non-voting status now, and we'd just like to continue that same non-voting ex officio membership. In terms of the permanence of the council, we do intend this to be a permanent council and not to dissolve after 1 year. And as far as whether the commissioner can dissolve this, I think since the legislature is putting it into its existence, it probably should be tied to a legislative decommissioning.
So, Mr. Chairman,
I'm not quite sure about that. The first two pieces we're real good on, I think.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Erickson Ropes, if you want to do that in order to make it consistent with making it permanent, then on page 2, line 23, delete everything after the first period, just that sentence that reads, the commissioner may disband the council at any time. And that way it wouldn't be in conflict with the new subdivision 5 making it permanent.
I'd like to move ahead with those recommendations from Mr. Bottern. So if we could incorporate those changes into the bill, I'll put the bill on before the committee with those amendments.
Senator Robles, I want to ask Senator Council to run down the changes, and then we'll take them in one, all three of those changes in one change, put it in the bill.
Mr. Chairman, the changes would be as follows. On page 1, line 19, after officio, insert, comma, non-voting. On page 2, line 23, delete the sentence that reads, the commissioner may disband the council at any time, and insert subdivision 5 with a headnote, expiration, notwithstanding section 15.059, subdivision 5, the council is permanent and does not expire.
Okay. Any questions on that part of the bill so far? Senator Robles moves those amendments to get the bill in the shape that you would like to have it in. So, any further discussion on the amendments? Not all in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? So adopted. Now the bill should be in order that you'd like to have it.
Thank you.
Senator Robles, what do you want to do now?
We're ready to move the bill, unless there's anyone else that'd like to speak to the bill or
I
have any questions.
I apologize. I should ask if anybody in the audience is wanting to add anything to it. I think it's pretty forward. It kind of gets us right where we wanted to be. Okay. All those in favor?
Where's this bill going?
Yeah. Senator Robles moves that Senate File 3281, as amended, be recommended to pass, and it has to be referred to state and local governments because of the nature
committee.
Of the bill. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, members. We have a second bill before you that has to do with...
Senator Robles, wait a minute, Senator Coyne.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to, you probably already know this, but the Senate is supposed to reconvene at 4 o'clock. If you got that notice, all the members are supposed to be up there at 4 o'clock.
Well, Senator Coring, all the members weren't here at 3 o'clock.
Okay.
Sorry.
You could be the bearer of bad news.
We'll do as much as we can. I can't. Senator Rope, do your next bill.
Thank you. We have a second bill, 3282, that is before you. This is has to do with the creation of a new deputy commissioner. We're very pleased to have a Veterans Health deputy commissioner added to the staff. And this was another recommendation that came out of the governor's long-term care task force from this interim. Again, this is another bill that is a result of a long collaborative discussion between all the stakeholders that I mentioned the first time. So we're real pleased to put this bill before you. We have actually hired a new deputy commissioner, and everyone seems to be extremely pleased, not only about the job and the duties, but the man himself. So we're real pleased to be before you today. And if you have any additional questions on the technical aspects, I'll let Christine Keel take those.
Okay. Anybody would like to testify on the bill?
Okay.
And members, I'm going to try to speed along so we don't have the pleasure of keep moving them week to week.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee, representing the AFSCME Council 5. And I think you know, of course, over the past couple of years, we've had a number of incidents we've had to deal with at the Minneapolis Veterans Home. We happen to represent people at the veterans homes around the state, including at Minneapolis. We think the commission that the governor appointed, and on which Senator Erickson Ropes is one of the members, did a very fine job of considering all these issues, and we strongly supported their recommendation to move governance to the Department of Veterans Affairs. And I think it's the bill before you creating this position. I think it is our hope, given the creation of the position and also the person that's been appointed, is that having a person in charge or overseeing this that has a background in health care and long-term care will be very helpful. It's been our effort as one of the unions representing a number of employees at the homes that we are going to do everything we can to build a much more positive working relationship with the department and with that deputy commissioner, and hopefully will minimize, if not eliminate, problems we've had at the homes in the past so that the veterans can have the great care they deserve. Thank you.
Any other discussion?
I'd like to move Senate File 3282 to pass, and I'm not sure where it's headed. To the floor? Sorry.
Because we're doing rulemaking and
okay.
Am I right? Senator Robes moves that Senate File 3282 be recommended pass and be referred to state and local government operations. Any discussion? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? So adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Two more bills. It shouldn't take too long.
Senator Vickerman, Senate File number 3050. See, Senator, you have a bill moving the expiration date for the Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council, which has been doing great work. Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I'm here today. Right now I'm trying to find my bills. I would like to move Senate File 3050 if the committee so far agrees to it, and it simply is a change in date. And if you look on the bill, the section expires on June 30th, 2013 instead of 2008. I want to just move it on so it doesn't quit. And I don't know if you need a lot. I think most of you know what MALAC is. Rather than take a lot of time unless you want it.
Senator Vickerman moves Senate File number 3050
state and local.
Be recommended to pass and referred to state and local. Any questions, members? Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'd just like to say that I've been on the Minnesota Ag Education Leadership Council since it was formed 10 years ago, and it has done a great job in promoting ag education in the state. We had a situation 10 years ago where there weren't hardly enough teachers getting trained to keep the program going anymore, and this organization has done a great job under the leadership of Julie Tesh, and before her it was Steve Wenzel's L.A., what was his name? I forgot right now.
Pat Blonsky,
yeah. And it's really reinvigorated the ag education program throughout the state.
And is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File number 3050? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman renews his motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's passed. Thank you, Senator Vickerman. Senator Vickerman,
Chair,
number 3262.
And that just a little, technical changes. Look at the bill as we're going into cellulose. For making ethanol instead of just corn and beans and that, so we want to add 2.2 representing the forest products industry. We want to add one more member to the Next Gen board. Up through it, rid of the expiration date, expired in 2009. That was delete. Put down to 3.7, $3 million for the first years for grants to these projects. If we don't use the money, it goes into the general fund, am I right?
That's correct.
And I want to be sure it stays where we want it to stay in, the Energy Division. And if you look on the page 7, or page 3 out of 7, 4.21, any unencumbered balances does not cancel at the end of the first year and is available in the second year. We want to be sure we keep the money we have and it don't go into the general fund. And that's just the changes. I have Shin Quinney from the department that could maybe say a few words. Otherwise, we're going to move along and we're going to make for it.
I'm Quinn Cheney with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair. And I was the staff person for the Next Gen Energy Board. We met about 10 times over the course of the summer and fall and developed a report which is available online, and I can get members copies of that if you'd like. And Senator Vickerman has already gone through the changes, so if you have any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cheney. Any questions, members? Mr. Botern, do you have something that we need to add to Senate File 3262?
Mr. Chairman, looking at page 2 of the bill on line 19, the expiration date is stricken. And I think the intent is to perhaps, well, I'm not sure, maybe make it permanent or extend it some length of time. But the effect of doing this would actually be, without notwithstanding the section in Chapter 15 that was referenced in the earlier bill, it would wind up sunsetting July 1st, 2009, or at least there'd be an ambiguity that way. So if you want to make it permanent, I can supply you with language for that, or if you want to extend the expiration date, that would require a different amendment, and leave that to the discussion of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Bodern. And
sure, it's in mind.
Senator Vickerman, do you have thoughts on the expiration date? Should we let this expire at the same time that the previous bill did?
Mr. Chair, we're just starting into this next generation, next gen board. I would like to make it a permanent board because it's going to take 10, 15, 20 years before we really get going. I think I'm right. That would save a lot of confusion.
Okay. Mr. Bodern, could you provide us a language with that author's amendment to this, please?
Mr. Chairman, on page 2, line 19, reinstate the stricken subdivision 5 expiration period, and after the stricken language, insert notwithstanding section 15.059 subdivision 5, the board is permanent and does not expire.
Thank you, Mr. Bodern.
Members, Mr. Chair, I will make that motion to change that part, and then before I do that, what about the other Senate Council? What about the other two changes? Do they do anything with them?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Vickerman, I think those work just fine.
One of the key things that we are I'm concerned about is I want to be sure that the money stays so we can use it the next year rather than go into.
Senator Vickerman, the way I'm reading the language on 4.21, on 4.23, that any unencumbered balance, it would not cancel and would be available in the second year. Mr. Bodern, does that language, or Mr. Mueller, does that do what Senator Vickerman is looking to do?
Mr. Chairman, yes, and actually right now there's some discussion. We'll have to probably see this bill back after it goes to state and local government, and have it come back to the Finance Committee and examine about the if there's any costs that we'll have to carry because of this. The intent was last year, I believe, to probably have this language or something similar in the bill, and there was actually some effort last year to get this language into a reviser bill that it didn't get into that, and now we're almost in the next fiscal year, whether we have to count this as costs if they don't have all these grants encumbered already. We're still talking with finance about that. So when we get the bill back, hopefully we'll have that issue resolved.
Members clear on that? Any questions, members? Anyone in the audience that wants to testify on Senate File 3262? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman renews his motion that Senate File 3262 be recommended to pass and referred to state and local.
Yep.
State and local.
I asked for it.
Yes. Did we adopt the amendment?
Oh, I apologize. Senator Vickerman moves his author's amendment on the expiration date, making this permanent. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Now, Senator Vickerman.
Motion. I thought I heard you said failed, Mr. Chair.
Passes. Motion prevailed. There you go. Senator
Vickerman. I'm not as deaf as you would think. I heard you say
I apologize. Senator Vickerman renews his motion to Senate File number 3262 be recommended to pass and referred to state and local.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hahn.
Yeah, I just have a question. I'm just reading on page 5 of the bill. There is some text in parentheses 5.6 to 5.8 saying that preceding text indicated going back to line 4.24 was vetoed. My question is it being reinserted into this bill, even though the governor has vetoed the language previously, or is it just in there saying that this is no longer in this section of the law because the governor vetoed it? I'm not quite sure what that means. I've never seen that in a bill before.
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, that text refers to a veto. And this bill will not change that at all. Actually, the veto was an appropriation that's separate of the $3,000 next-gen board. There was a separate appropriation on line 4.24.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Mueller,
Senator Hamm.
That was kind of my question. It's referring to some language beginning on line 4.24 and extending over to 5.6. So if I'm understanding you, all that language we should consider as essentially gone from this provision. Is that correct?
Mr. Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, when we're revising previous session laws, we pull up the whole section of the law. So we wouldn't be changing any of the line item veto, the effect of any of that. But we just had to pull in this whole section or subdivision of session law to amend it. But since we're not changing any part of that appropriation that was line item veto, the effect of a line item veto would not change at all.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any more questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Bill's passed.
Mr. Chair.
I've never seen that before.
Have we got time for one more? Okay. And that will be, what number is that? Senator Anderson.
It's going to be more complicated, though.
Hey, what they told
this is complicated.
They want us up.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I have to talk really fast.
Okay. Right. You could, but what it means.
Senator Anderson.
We better not be late. So you and I got scolded today. We better not be late.
I made this up. Rookie.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate File 2876 relates to regulation of dangerous dogs, or actually I'd prefer to say to the owners of dangerous dogs. That's really what this bill is focused on. And, you know, I live in a city district in St. Paul where we've had some bad experiences with attacks on children and adults from dangerous dogs. And
there was discussion in my community about the dog breed ban bill, and I do not support that approach, and so I was really interested in talking with the groups that are advocating for this approach as an alternative to that, because I think it's important for us to take the issue seriously about how to protect the public, but to do it in a way that is logical, reasonable, and balances the rights of dog owners with the rights of the public. And that's what this bill is intended to do. And it's promoted in particular by the Minnesota Animal Control Association. So let me just briefly explain what the bill does. And I have Bill Forbes from the Animal Control Association who can talk to you in a little bit more detail as time permits and help me answer questions in the next 2 minutes. Essentially, this bill... There were several changes and amendments that were made in the House version of this bill as an effort to compromise, and I've incorporated all of those changes in a delete all amendment. So I should probably get that in front of us first. I would ask if the committee would adopt the author's amendment A1, and then I can explain it in that shape.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All those in favor of adopting the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Now your bill should be where you want it.
That's right, Mr. Chair. Thank you. So I will work off the A1 amendment. The bill changes enforcement of dogs from the counties and allows the animal control authorities to take the primary responsibility for that enforcement. It includes new language allowing an owner to request a hearing and have a due process, an impartial third-party hearing, if their dog is labeled dangerous, so that they have a right to a hearing and some due process. The bill does crack down on dangerous repeat offender dogs and their owners. It requires, if your dog is designated as a dangerous dog, it requires sterilization of that dog. So it changes that from voluntary to mandatory. So that is one of the significant changes. And it increases penalties for those who are responsible for making or owning dangerous dogs through their irresponsible actions. Some of the compromises in the delete all amendment, which are now incorporated in the bill in front of you, include increasing the bonding amount, the amount of insurance or the bond that must be purchased in order to protect the public from any potential injury if you do want to keep a dog that's designated dangerous. So we increase that amount from $50,000 to $300,000. We've removed penalties that were in the felony level, that were in the original bill. And we require a third conviction for the registration, identification, and restraint requirements. There's also a prohibition on dog ownership in this bill. If you prove, essentially through your actions, that you're not going to be a responsible dog owner, and it takes a series of very serious violations of law for that to ever kick in. It's essentially a three strikes and you're out requirement. So if you're convicted three times repeatedly of allowing dangerous dogs, which do attack humans, or if you violate other very, very serious laws in relationship to your dog ownership, then you are prohibited from owning a dog or anyone in your household. But part of the compromise that we're proposing in this amendment is that after 3 years, you could come in and try to make the case that you have learned how to be a better dog owner and you are responsible, so that you could, it wouldn't be a lifetime prohibition. So just briefly, Section 1 defines provocation. I'll just go through the sections quickly and then allow for some testimony. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 7 are the surety bond and the warning symbol being taken over by animal control. 5 and 6 are really technical. Sections 8, 9, and 10 require the designated dangerous dog to be sterilized, and if it's not done, provides for seizure of the dog.
Senator Anderson, I hate to do this to
you, but
I've been told we're supposed to be on the floor, and that's now. Well, what are you going to do? Do you want to back later?
Whoa.
Mr. Chair, if we finished in five or 10 minutes, are they going to come and drag us out?
Well, I can stay
here. I don't
know. Oh. I don't know how long. It wasn't going to be very long. We can come back because we're supposed to be here till 5 or maybe some.
Yeah, that's whatever you, Mr. Chair, it's totally up to you. I basically explained the bill. So,
recess.
I imagine there may be questions, and I know Mr. Forbes can educate you about this.
So, I'm going to recess the call of the chair.
I was going to move to pass the bill.
Okay. Well, you can stick around. Beyond next, hopefully. Okay. I think I've set plenty.
Calling the committee back to order.
Already?
Senator Anderson. I told him on the floor we'd be done in 15 minutes, so we got to get to moving.
Now would be a good time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're back. We're
waiting for you to hurry up.
All right. I can take a hint. That's direct. Mr. Forbes is here from the Minnesota Animal Control Association, and he'd like to say a few words in support of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Bill Forbes. I'm Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota Animal Control Association. And I thank the chair and the committee for hearing what I have to say. MACA, I should explain, is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization. We're not real big. There aren't that many animal control people. But our mission is to provide education, training, and so forth in animal control issues, and also to provide professional information to elected officials when dealing with animal issues where they need some professional input, which is why I'm here. We've alluded a little bit already. Senator Anderson mentioned the breed ban hysteria that was going around earlier in the year and last year. I won't touch on that too much. We don't feel that's the way to get anything done, and it's probably counterproductive. What we have right now is a situation where most bites are to kids, and most of the victims know the dog, are acquainted with them either in their own household or in situations where they know the dog down the street, the mean dog down the street or something like that. It's not stray dogs. There are relatively light penalties right now as it stands for what I'm calling dangerous owners of dogs rather than dangerous dog owners, which can be confusing. And those folks don't pay much when these things come up. When they violate dangerous dog laws, generally what happens is the dog gets put to sleep by the court, and then the court says to the dog owner, well, you've suffered enough, you've lost your dog, so we're not going to do anything to you. And we're trying to kind of turn that around a little bit and try and get at where the problem is, which is the dangerous owner of dogs. We don't have a lot of data out there on animal bites, breeds, severity of bites. There have been a number of studies done nationwide, but there is just not any kind of repository of good data on these things. So when I talk about dangerous owners of dogs, I have to rely on close to 30 years of experience doing animal control and the input of fellow animal control professionals who have seen these things before. And what I would say, if we're trying to talk about a dangerous owner of dog, we frequently get into issues where people are making a lot of assumptions. And I just want to say that the people that I've dealt with over the years, You can't say it's a racial thing. You can't say it's a thing having to do with culture or income. It crosses all those lines. But what we do see are things like they're generally men, but not always. They don't socialize their dogs properly or train them properly. They often chain their dogs up, sometimes inside the house as well as out, which will make a dog aggressive. They often allow their animals to run loose. Frequently, they don't supervise kids with their dogs. We had a serious bite in my community just about a month ago where a dog that had already attacked somebody, it was a 130-pound dog that had already attacked somebody a couple of years ago, was being taken care of by the ex-girlfriend of the fellow who was out of town, and she let the dog out when the kids came to play with it and said, "Can we play with the dog?" which they had done before. And she let the dog out, turned around, went back in the house, and the dog almost killed the 7-year-old because the person in charge of the dog was not being very bright. Leaving dogs alone with kids is not a smart thing, but they do this a lot. They have a history often of domestic violence or violent crime. They often have a background of animal neglect or abuse. We see a lot of people have lots and lots of tickets. And a lot of times they don't pay those tickets, and in fact maybe they get to the point where they've been summoned into court, and they don't show up for that either, and they end up getting arrested when their taillight is out for not paying a fine on some minor thing. A lot of DUIs, a lot of driver's license suspensions for no insurance, expired plates, not paying fines, disorderly conduct, drug issues, property crimes. They don't license their dogs, and they've had potentially dangerous or dangerous dogs in the past. A lot of times there are people who have had just endless complaints from the neighbors and about their dogs. Sometimes they report them to us, sometimes they don't. And all this kind of stuff goes together. I hate the word profiling, but if you take the average dangerous owner of a dog, that's who you're dealing with. It's going to be somebody who's got a lot of these characteristics. And what we're trying to do here is to put the onus on those folks. You know, if they're not going to play by the rules, what else are we going to do? We're going to have to go after them, not their dogs. It's not the dog. And I know that sounds almost trite, but it's true. What we're doing here is we're trying to clean up the bill or the law, first of all. This thing's been on the books since 1988, and it's been tweaked and tweaked and tweaked, but we're continuing to do that. Provocation is always a bone of contention when somebody's dog is declared potentially dangerous or dangerous, and there's nothing that really says what that is. It's not easily defined, but we've come up with a definition that we feel is appropriate. We've run it by an awful lot of people who agree, and it's also in statute elsewhere with reference to other matters, but essentially the same sort of thing. We're requiring sterilization of dangerous dogs with this bill, which is appropriate. We don't want dogs that are badly behaved to be out there getting bred with more dogs that are badly behaved, and it also is a very good thing to do in terms of reducing aggression from animals. Unneutered male dogs are far more likely to bite, and unneutered female dogs actually are fairly easily convinced to bite in some situations. So that's important. In the past, we haven't had in this law a hearing process or due process on a lot of issues here, and we've tried to cover some of that by putting in a hearing procedure. It's clear that there should be a hearing procedure. If your dog is declared dangerous, you should have an ability to go before an impartial hearing officer and appeal your situation. Also, there is some wording in there where if a dog is confiscated under the dangerous dog law and you get charged with something, you go to court and you get found not guilty, currently you still have to pay for the impoundment and the board and so forth, and this bill would eliminate that. If you're found not guilty, you don't have to pay, which I think is reasonable. The section on destroying dogs is really just a suggestion. It's added to existing law, which gives some guidelines for reasons you might want to consider ordering a dog destroyed. To help smaller jurisdictions where they don't deal with this a lot, it gives them an idea of the sorts of things that might be considered when ordering a dog destroyed for particular activities. I can go into that more if we want to, but I don't think we need to. A lot of this is cleanup. The dangerous dog tag and warning signs, there's language in existing law that directs the Commissioner of Public Safety to produce the tag and the sign. That's been done long ago, so we just dropped it out of there. We don't need to talk about it anymore. It's a done thing. The Animal Control Authority thing has caused a good deal of concern with some people who I think don't really understand what happened here. When this law came into effect in 1988, the counties were assigned the responsibility of registering and doing all the things they had to do for dangerous dogs in their county, and the counties did not want to do that. They didn't have any expertise in it, and they didn't have budgets to be assigning people to do these things, and they wanted out. And a few years ago, the legislature said, okay, you don't have to do that. We'll let the local animal control authority take care of the registration. In the process, though, we left the county in a number of places where probably it should have said animal control authority. The biggest objection when that passed was from Minneapolis, who said, wait a minute, we got a lot of dangerous dogs, and we're going to go out there and we're going to investigate this, we're going to inspect the premises, we're going to issue all this stuff, and then the money's going to the county? Wait a minute. So really we're just cleaning that up and making it more clear what's what, but it's really not changing anything. The final bit in the bill, I'm going to get back to the ownership business, but the final bit where it says that animal control authority must enforce this law regardless of whether or not they've incorporated into local ordinance as a result of a rather strange three-judge panel of the appeals court had a decision a couple of years ago that was, I can only say, bizarre, which basically said that this legislature has discussed this whole thing over and over and over again and voted on it since 1988 repeatedly, and I will bet you that nobody on either side of any of these issues ever thought they were voting on a suggestion, but that's what this court seemed to think. And they were saying, you know, unless you've incorporated this bill into your city ordinance or your county ordinance, you can't enforce it. And we're trying to just take care of that. I don't think it's an issue. But as far as the repeat offenders, I just want to emphasize that if we get to the point where someone is being deprived of the right to own a dog, it's not because they had a dog declared dangerous. It's because they have repeatedly done a number of things after their dog is declared dangerous, or they have negligently committed second-degree manslaughter with their dog, or had repeat violations of serious statutes. And somebody's not going to be just said, hey, you know, you've got a dog that bit somebody, you can't have dogs anymore. That's not the intent here at all. City of St. Paul has already enacted a city ordinance that does essentially the same thing. I don't see this being used very often because you don't usually get that far with people, but when you do get a truly dangerous owner of dogs, this is the way we feel we should deal with it. Thank you.
Senator Anderson, Senate Council's got a couple technical amendments. Maybe right. We should put it on to get the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I have at least one of the changes in writing. I'll just have that amendment distributed now and explain that while it's being distributed. On page 3, line 5, there's a reference to there's a requirement that when a dangerous dog is transferred to a new location, it must be the Animal Control Authority must be notified.
Thank you.
Looking at this, it seems like it could be read literally so that any transfer to a new location, like taking the dog for a walk or visiting somebody for the weekend, would trigger that. So this amendment, just after location, would insert where the dog will reside to make it clear that's when the dog actually moves to a new location where it will be kept. And then there are two other items that should be taken care of orally. The first is on page 6, subdivision 3, beginning on line 8. And the way that reads, right now it says, beginning 3 years after an animal control authority prohibits a person from owning a dog under subdivision 1. The reference to subdivision 1 picks up a lot of other, it's a list of other crimes that would essentially prevent the person from owning a dog. And this won't really work the way it's written because it's not an animal control authority convicting the person of those crimes. So what you would need to do to fix that would be on line 8, delete an animal, and on line on page 6, line 8, and on page 6, line 9, delete control authority, and then insert a conviction under subdivision 1, and then on the also on line 9, delete the under subdivision 1 where it appears later in that sentence. And then the third technical item is on the last page, that section that you were just discussing on page 7. On line 24, it says these sections 347.50 to 347.56 must be enforced by state and local animal control authorities or law enforcement agencies. Where you see state and local on line 24, that's basically redundant because animal control authority is defined in the law that applies to these sections to include the state and local authorities already. So you can just, you would delete on page 7, line 24, state and local.
Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, those are all very good suggestions. Appreciate those.
I'm going to ask Senate counsel to go through those quickly so everybody understands what the motion would be to, what the amendment would be to your bill, Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman and members, this would include the A2 amendment as it is written. And then on page 6, line 8, delete an animal. And on page 6, line 9, delete control authority and insert under subdivision 1, and then delete under subdivision 1 where it appears later in that sentence on that line. And then on page 7, line 24, delete state and local.
You can add that after 1 on 6.9.
And Mr. Knapp has pointed out on line 6.9, where we inserted under subdivision 1, a conviction under subdivision 1, probably be a good idea grammatically to put in that. So it would read, beginning 3 years after a conviction under subdivision 1, that prohibits a person from owning a dog, et cetera. And you could take those all as one motion.
Senator Anderson, do you want to make a motion to?
I can't move it, but I support
you
the
can.
Amendment.
Senator
yes.
Scoy, you
I'll move it.
Does everybody understand the motion? The amendment, I should say. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? All adopted. Do you have anybody else? I have something.
I don't, Mr. Chair.
I have a Mr. Al Sinkus. I don't know if I spelled the name right, but come up and let's.
We need you again. Thank you, Jeff.
Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
My name is Al Kaczynskis. I'm a resident of St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm also a member of Minnesota Responsible Animal Owners Alliance. And if you'll bear with me, I've never done anything like this in my life, so I'm a little... I can't exactly say ill at ease. Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, members of the committee, I would like to thank you all on behalf of the responsible animal owning community for devoting your energies in an effort to resolve what has proved to be a controversial and complex issue in our state. Basically, the spirit of this particular piece of legislation, I believe is good. It's in some of the language that we believe there's a little bit of a problem. And so starting in 34750, subdivision 8. It states that provocation means an act that an adult could reasonably expect may cause a dog to attack or bite. At this point, I would think it's unreasonable to expect that every adult human being is capable of making decisions in regard to the complex to complex canine behavior. For example, a dog senses a smell. We may not all be aware of that. May trigger certain behaviors. A dog may regard to a direct stare. Maybe not everybody's aware of that. Sometimes small children flapping their arms and running around screeching could be interpreted as prey for the dog if they're small enough. I think that's why we run into problems with small children a lot. Waking a dog from sleep, et cetera. There are people in this audience that are probably a lot more well-qualified to address this than I am, but it's just the idea that, you know, not everybody understands everything there is to know about dogs. Secondly, in 347-59, subdivision 9, it addresses contracted services, and it says that an animal control authority may contract with another political subdivision or other person to provide services required under sections, notwithstanding to any contract entered under, et cetera. I've spoken to a number of people that feel this amendment takes responsibility from elected and accountable units of government and puts culpability on the private entity, which could result in additional legislation in the event of a dispute and has no accountability at this point at the state, county, or municipal levels. I mean, there's no record, not a lot of record keeping done on this. I think that Mr. Forbes had briefly alluded to that we don't have any central database in the state to keep track of these things. And the other thing, though, is the idea, the fear is that, you know, it's like a private entity, and I just need to bring that up. I'm certain that wasn't even thought about when this was drafted. And the other point along there is that monies are paid to a private concern that should go back to the state, county, or municipality for administration or enforcement of this law. And I don't understand all there is to know about those concerns, but I'm just raising the issue. Thirdly, an animal control authority shall require a dangerous dog to be sterilized at the owner's expense. If the owner does not have an animal sterilized within 30 days, the animal control authority shall seize the dog and have it sterilized at the owner's expense. Quite simply, you know, some have asked, are there no exceptions? Does this mean never? I heard something long ago in my career that somebody said, well, you never say never. And so that would be one thing. Is this 100% of the time? Fourthly, this would be under 347.541, subdivision 1, and it speaks to a hearing. The owner of any dog declared dangerous has the right to a hearing by an impartial officer. Impartial, according to the dictionary, you know, talks about favoring neither, disinterested, treating all alike, unbiased, equitable, and just. And boy, an awful lot of us in this state have experience with dogs on one side or the other, and I would just be curious as to what would determine an impartial hearing officer at this point, whether it would be someone employed by the animal control, or would be a task force appointed by the state, or some judicial arm. Fifth would be the destruction of a dog in certain circumstances, you know, and we would ask what constitutes certain circumstances. Under legal definition, I mean, you can find there are definitions for aggravating circumstances, attendant circumstances, exigent circumstances, extenuating circumstances, but certain circumstances, you know, what constitutes certain circumstances in that particular case? I would think the use of that word kind of connotates that there would be something in particular there as opposed to the word certain. Then the other thing that we found confusing is that early on there are some sentences stricken, and they would be under subdivision 1, I think it was subdivision 1, and replaced afterwards in subdivision 2. And so due process is removed from subdivision 1 and replaced in subdivision 2. Is there due process under subdivision 1? Is that inclusive in subdivision 2? I know it's kind of a goofy question, but I, you know, it's the way it flows. So I guess that's about all I had to say at this point. And once again, I would like to thank you all, Mr. Chairman, committee, and Senator Anderson for the opportunity to seek some clarification on these items.
Thank you very much. Anybody else in the audience want to speak for or against?
Could I ask a question?
Yeah, you can go ahead. Go ahead, Senator Deal.
I'd like to ask the witness a question.
Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, you said that you thought there should be some exceptions for castration. What exceptions were you thinking about?
None in particular. I would think that should come up in hearing as to whether there were or there were not.
Okay.
That's just in our opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and Senator Dill, in your other life, I'm sure you get to deal with an issue like this from time to time. What do they normally do out in Meeker when they have an animal that's been biting kids and stuff? Exactly. That's exactly what they do in my neck of the woods, too. So I don't know. I think Senator Anderson has kind of tried to, you know, and this is an issue that's been in front of us, I don't know how many years. I've been here, what's it been, 15 or 16 now? And I think that, you know, we hear about these dangerous animals almost every year, if not every other year. And, you know, in other parts of the state, that's dealt with in quite a different manner than what Senator Anderson is doing here. She's trying to do something that protects especially kids. And you were talking about earlier, you know, kids running around waving their arms. A lot of times kids don't know that there are, you know, certain dogs that have been not bred but trained, that is an aggressive type behavior. And, you know, it's not the kids' fault, but, you know, I think Senator Anderson's just trying to keep the kids around here a little safer and move some of these animals out of neighborhoods where they can be problems, because I can guarantee you we don't, in Goodhue, Minnesota, they don't have that problem. So
I have a young lady in.
Do you want to testify?
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Yeah. And there'll be two more hearings.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kate Ann Hunter. I'm a veterinarian practicing in Minnesota, a graduate of the University of Minnesota, and past president of the Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. Also been a dog trainer, handler, and teacher for many years, so have both a professional and a personal interest in how dogs of all types are treated in this state. I want to assure you that veterinarians' primary concern is for the animals as an integral part of our community, because none of our patients come in for care without a human attached to them. We're well aware as veterinarians of our responsibility to protect not just our animal patients, but the families and the communities that these animals live in. Like so many things in life, dogs are considered by most to enhance lives of the people around them, but there's no doubt that in the wrong hands, like a carelessly driven car, they can be very dangerous. And veterinarians and dog trainers who've dedicated their lives to improving the quality of life for humans and their canine companions know all too well the consequences of serious dog bites. You can ask any veterinarian how many times they've been bitten. Any measures that can increase the enforcement of current animal cruelty, animal welfare, and dog bite investigation and consequences would be welcome. And strict regulation towards owners whose dogs have harmed others protects all of us. I appreciate that there's been no mention of any breed-specific legislation. The research has shown that by trying to protect society by banning specific breeds doesn't make the public any safer. Veterinarians prefer to approach the issues from a strictly scientific basis, but I can assure you that I'm also speaking with passion against breed-specific legislation on behalf of my own dog, who may be part pit bull. He's my constant companion, teammate, and also spent last Saturday sitting on the bed with a friend who's dying of cancer. And you all know many dogs of every breed who have both good reputations and bad reputations. It's not possible for us to distinguish on breed alone. For all the dogs that we know in our lives, both the good ones and the bad ones, let's assure all Minnesotans that we can live together with our canine companions and enjoy the benefits of each other's company and keep everyone safe. Thank you.
Well, Senator Anderson, we talked about this before we moved the bill along here, and I wanted to be sure we didn't name any breeder dog. I've got bit by a St. Bernard, and I got bit harder by a little rat terrier, and he's about that tall. He just wouldn't let go. I was shaking my foot as hard as I could. He just hung on. So I compliment you. All the phone calls we got was they were afraid you were going to name breeds, and you cleaned it up, I think, 100%.
Well, and Mr. Chair, actually, I never supported that approach, although when we heard from my constituents a lot of fear and concern about children not being safe in the neighborhoods, I did look at that issue, and I read as much as I could about it, and I came down in the same conclusion as our doctor friend here. It just doesn't make any sense, and it's not right. So I don't support that, and I wouldn't support any amendments that would go in that direction at all. This bill is intended to take a totally different approach and look at human responsibility and just make sure that we take care of the public safety, we make sure that if owners are not doing their job, that they have serious consequences and that they have to take responsibility for their actions, and that there's also a fair level of due process in the process along the way. And this bill would have to go to Judiciary Committee, and they're going to look at a lot of those specific issues the other gentleman referenced about the hearings and the some of the other questions, as well as state and local government, which would also look more at the question of county versus animal control authority. So I think those issues will be fully discussed as well. And so I would I appreciate what Senator Murphy said, and that really reflects my intentions.
Any further questions for the doctor? If not, you can. Senator Dill, but a question for the veterinary?
No.
Bam, you can step aside, and then Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm wondering about the insurance requirement here. And I just want to share with you my recent experience on this. What the current law says is you need to have a $50,000 policy. And I just called up my insurance agent just recently. He said the standard homeowner, farm owner policy is a $300,000 liability, which is what you've gone to here. But he said if the owner of the home has a dangerous dog, they would drop the policy completely. They wouldn't insure that type of person. And about 3 months ago in my Senate district, there was a person that moved into Lester Prairie with a pit bull, and the local authorities deemed it to be a dangerous dog. And in order to keep that dog from being euthanized, he had to get a $50,000 policy on his dog, which he could not find. And because he couldn't find it, the I don't know if it was a county or the city, decided to waive that requirement. So he has to do everything else for a dangerous dog, with a warning sign and this pen and the muzzle and all this and that. But they set aside the $50,000 requirement because he looked and looked and couldn't find it. So I'm just wondering, What I'm wondering is if you can buy a $300,000 policy on a dangerous dog in this state.
Senator Anderson, do you know?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Forbes to help on that. I know this was that was added as an amendment and in the House, and that was part of our compromise effort. So maybe Mr. Forbes can help answer that. I really don't know the answer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dill, it is possible to do it. It's very expensive. The difference between $50,000 and $300,000 really isn't too much from the point of view of the insurance company. If you can get one, you can get the other. But getting it at all is going to be a challenge. But it can be done.
Well,
Senator Dale, follow up.
Okay, what I'm thinking about here is if we could add some language that would make it possible for the local authorities to waive that requirement if the person couldn't find the insurance at their discretion, kind of like Lester Prairie did. I guess Lester Prairie or McLeod County, whichever one it was, probably broke the law if they have a dangerous dog and that dog should be dead right now. But the owner loved him so much, he tried and tried, and he saved his dog's life, I guess, at the end. And then the other, so I just want to draw that to people's attention to think about. And then the other thing, which I've already talked to several people about, is this on page 6, line 6.6, there is this requirement that if you are, well, I'll just read it, household members. No member of a household may own a dog where a person resides who is prohibited from dog ownership from subdivision 1. And I'm just wondering if there could be some wiggle room in there. If you have a situation where you've got some kid who's bonded with a dog who's not causing any trouble, and just because his dad has got a dog that's causing trouble, and he's a bad dad and a bad dog owner and so on, I hate to see the government show up and wrest this dog from this child's loving arms and bring it down to the dog pound. And maybe there's some words that could be crafted there to allow for some possible exception in that situation.
Well, Senator Dill, this bill makes it out of here. It can go 2 stops, state and local. That might kind of take care of yours, or it goes to judiciary, whichever way it needs to go. And so I would ask if it does pass, Senator Anderson would work with some of these, because you've come a long way from the first time we had this bill together. And I think it's a good bill. I think it's a good compromise. And I'm trying to figure out why, if I had a dangerous dog, why I'd even keep a dangerous dog. Mm-hmm. I mean, a dangerous dog can bite you. I've been bit by my own dogs, too. So if you know one, it's vicious. And I have 14 grandkids. Why would I have a dangerous dog?
I can answer that.
They might turn on them.
Because, Mr. Chair, it's because you are not a dangerous owner of dogs. Most of the responsible people will put their animal down if something horrendous happens. They're not going to go through a lot of stuff to avoid the responsibility.
Senator Chaudhry?
I would add to that, Mr. Chair, there are people who are not... that don't have ill intent with their dogs or are mean to their dogs, but they are so loose with their dogs that they don't do anything about their dogs when they're puppies and they mouth people and they grow up thinking that it's okay to bite.
Just like them.
And so it's not necessarily even a an ill intent intended person that leads to a dangerous dog, but it can be the sweetest of people. This is my baby. I'm not gonna discipline. And example was last weekend. I took my 3-year-old to the dog park. Been to the dog park many times with my kid. Not a single problem ever with a single dog. We're walking along, not doing anything. My son is walking next to me. I keep him close to me at the dog park just in case. And here's a Great Dane that kind of starts to stalk him. Interested. Smaller little human being. And came up and kind of nibbled or mouthed, not sniff, but mouthed his ankle. So I shoot him away. We're walking along. Great Dane comes back. This time, really goes after his ankle. And so I just laid a boot into that dog. And I'm sorry, I have owned five dogs. I am an amateur trainer of dogs. I adore dogs. But when that happens, my three-year-old is more important. So the dog goes away. Young lady, very nice lady, comes up to me and says, "It's not necessary to kick the dog, sir." And I said, "Excuse me, it's not necessary for the dog to bite the child." And she's in denial whether that happened. So, okay, I take my son and our dogs to the other side of the dog park, almost a quarter mile away. We're there playing. Up comes trotting the same Great Dane, coming to check us out. So I pick up my son, and the owner, she's running after him, calling. Fido, not doing a thing. And it finally gets him away. Well, first of all, if my dog nibbled a kid in a public place, I'd be out of there. This was not a responsible dog owner. Was she a mean person? Absolutely not. She was a nice person. Too nice. That was the problem. You could be too nice. So, and frankly, I'm reading the definition here under the destruction of dogs, and I would have had a claim that Great Dane should have been destroyed. I didn't, because I took my own proper precautions, and I love dogs, and I want to see that happen. And that has never happened. Never happened since. She left. We went back, and all the other dogs were great. Of course, my son was a little traumatized. He stood up on the bench. Didn't want to get down. But I mean, that's what happens with irresponsible owners, whether they're ill-intended or not.
Yeah.
So, I just thought I needed to share that story and add that bit that it's not just the dog fighters that lead to dangerous dogs. It's the lax owners. So, but I apologize, Mr. Knopf. You were getting up. I was going to ask you a question about. I'm still confused about the definition of a dangerous dog, because Senator Dill had mentioned that pit bull was deemed to be a dangerous dog. Is that allowed for just be based on breed that? What is the definition of a dangerous dog?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, banning breeds of dogs is strictly prohibited in the law based on breed. Local governments can't do it either in Minnesota based on the breed of the dog. I think Senator Dill was talking about this dog must have had some other incidents or whatever, because they couldn't do it just because it was a pit bull.
I've got the police report right here. The dog did do some things to... I think the dog has to bite once, or it has to do something to get itself considered a dangerous dog. But then there's another category called potentially dangerous,
right?
Where you haven't bit anybody yet, but you've been thinking about it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know about the thought process, but there is a potentially dangerous dog that's a little bit it's a little different standard for potentially dangerous, but it does allow for them to be more easily determined to be dangerous dog if they've been determined potentially dangerous in advance. But I could, if you want the definition, I can read that. Otherwise, if you're satisfied, Senator Chaudhry,
No, someone handed it to me. Okay. I see it now.
And so Mr. Chair, we're not changing the definitions.
Right. No, I was just curious, and yeah, just to add that my wife is definitely afraid of black labs because her grandpa's black lab bit her, and her grandpa took the dog out back and shot him. So, and this was a Great Dane. I mean, I agree that certain breeds have certain instincts for what they do. But it's the owner that ultimately draws those instincts out.
Chair Sky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll move the bill to judiciary or state and local, wherever it's going to go. But I do have one quick question for Senator Anderson. And I don't serve on state and local government. But Section 16, I do have a question about that with regard to, you know, what type of animal control authorities, you know, these jurisdictions are going to be required to have. And maybe after you've gone through state and local government, I'll talk to you about that and see what you found out.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Square. I think those are good questions, and I honestly need to do a little bit more research on that as well. It's my understanding that the counties, they really like the idea that we have in this bill of animal control taking more responsibility. So that's the basics, that they're for it. But in terms of the details of how that would work legally, I will, I'll get back to you on that.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I raised a couple of issues here, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to move forward with any any amendments or ideas right now. But Mr. Knopf, in the meantime, has crafted some words, and maybe he can share them with you just to see what you think.
Mr. Chair, WCCO is calling me. What shall I tell them?
It passed.
It's about a different, completely different issue, Mr. Chair.
Put it on speaker or I'll say aye.
Allison, you better talk to him. Sorry.
Mr. Chairman, to get that Senator Dill's earlier issue about whether or not McLeod County or whoever, or Meeker County, whoever was the animal control authority, whether they could waive the insurance requirement, the one option that you'd have is to include a new paragraph B after line 1.23. That's an animal control authority may waive the requirement in paragraph A, clause 2, if the owner has made a reasonable effort to purchase a surety bond or insurance and found that they are not available. That would give the discretion to the animal control authority to waive that requirement. If you wanted to do that, and then to the other issue that Senator Dill raised, on the household members, if to give some discretion to the Animal Control Authority would be to delete on 6.6, no member, and insert an Animal Control Authority may prohibit members, and then delete may own, and then insert from owning. So it would read, an Animal Control Authority may prohibit members of a household from owning a dog where a person resides who is prohibited from dog ownership under Subdivision 1. So it gives some discretion to the Animal Control Authority to do that. I guess that's up to you. I just wanted to, there are some suggested language if you wanted to accomplish a couple of issues.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, what is your reaction to that?
Well, I understand what you're saying about the insurance, but I also, I think it's, the requirement is there for a good reason, in case there's an injury. So I wonder if there's any other options if someone cannot get insurance. Maybe they could give the dog to a friend who lives somewhere out in the country, you know?
Out of Minnesota.
are they going to try really hard to find insurance if they know they can, there's an out? So I'm not really thrilled with making a loophole there, honestly.
How about for the child or for the second dog in the house?
You're suggesting that animal control could make a waiver there, or that they would decide in all cases? I'm sorry, that language was that to say in all cases it would be up to animal control, or that you'd have to ask for an exception?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, the way I'd read it would be that they would make the decision to prohibit it, that the animal control authority would be as part of their jurisdiction over this person, over their ability to control, would make that decision to prohibit it.
I guess,
but it would be a waiver.
I guess, Mr. Chair, in that circumstance, I'd prefer it sort of to be flipped to say that the assumption is that no one in the household would have a dog unless animal control specifically authorized it, rather than automatically saying you could do it unless animal control acts. That would make it, available in those very rare circumstances where you might have a kid with a dog and this owner who has had three violations somehow didn't manage to taint that relationship and taint that dog. It's a little hard to imagine that circumstance, but that would allow for that.
Senator Morgan.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, I'm kind of hoping that
they don't find someone out in the country to take their dangerous dogs. Sorry. That's where I live.
Maybe that was insensitive.
But then I got to thinking, out in the country, we know how to deal with dangerous dogs. So, okay.
I know that rule.
I have a suggestion, members. It has to go to judiciary. It has to go to state and local. I sit on state and local, so does Senator Laurie. I don't know if anybody else does. I don't sit on judiciary, but you could work out some of these until we're sure we have a comfort zone.
Mr. Chair, I'm very happy to work with Senator Dill, Senator Scoy, to make sure that we can see if we can find an agreement on these issues. Sure. Absolutely.
Is that a quick note on this side?
Well, I'll just let it go for right now, and I'll visit with Senator Anderson later about it.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'll move that Senate File 2876 be recommended to pass and re-referred to state and local.
Senator Anderson, where do you want it to go first?
State and local? Okay. That's what my staff tells me. Yeah.
Senator Scoy, I move that Senate File 2876 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to state and local government operations. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. And
thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you,
adjourned.
Committee members.
So you're an expert.